everyone, and welcome back to another lovely edition of Camera Creations, our podcast that is now on show number 13, and it is the 18th of December. I'm here joined today by Chris Clayton and Ian Bundy and Charlie Winston. Hello, chaps.
Hello.
I guess that this is our Christmas edition, really. And I meant to ask you all before we were recording what we're going to do about the next one, because it's on New Year's Eve. Now, I previously said that I don't care. Every day is the same to me. But Chris Clayton, I think you said that you could, you were happy to join in. What's the thoughts on that?
I'm quite sad, so I've really got nothing else to do on New Year's Eve.
Is it worth having a show? Anyone else?
Yeah, I'm free.
Are you?
I'm quite sad.
I might be a bit challenged, I think, from my side. My wife may kill me, so...
But it sounds like we might have at least three people, so we could kind of do something probably. It will be our New Year's show, I suppose, and we can count this one as our Christmas show. So there you go. The theme on today's show is supposed to be travelling with gear, which was suggested by one of our lovely group members in MeWe. MeWe, where we hopefully pick up your comments and bring topics and stuff to this podcast to natter about. TedSalmon.com/camera creations is our website, and you'll get links to all the stuff we're talking about there. If you get lost and you want to get in on any of the MeWe stuff or any of our other audio podcasts, you can find all those at TedSalmon.com in the usual way. We do have a Camera Creations shared album in Google Photos. We'll put a link to that in the show notes, because that's where you will find all the pictures that we're going to be talking about on tonight's show. And so you can look in there as you follow along. So that's it. We should get going, really. Ed House left a message saying, really interesting discussion, as always, on the last show, gents. I agree with Joe on the new gear getting you out and about. I'm really trying to train myself away from that, though, just going out anyway. I'm not really doing very well at it, though. I keep thinking about full frame and then stopping myself at the last minute because I know I won't have the weight. I won't want the weight to carry or the lenses to go with it. I didn't really need the Olympus EM10 Mark IV, but I wanted it because it was nice and the price was good. I'm sure it will be worth it over the years, though. And collecting is a fun hobby too, let's not forget. Sometimes it's just nice to have something. Anyway, not everything in life has to be a need. We like a want and not a need. So thanks, Ed. And hopefully we'll catch you back on the show when you feel like you can join us in times to come. So that leads us nicely into the theme of the day. unless anyone's got any comments about what Ed said there. Anyone? Last chance? No? Right. The theme of the day being travelling with photography gear. Now, this was raised by Rohan Molligoda, who says, I wonder if you would consider talking about travelling with photography gear as a theme on the show. Your wishes are command. What you do or don't do to ensure your gear when you travel, for example. I'm taking a trip to Sri Lanka in January, and I'm looking into all of this now. It's just a hobby for me, but I'm interested to hear anyone's thoughts on it from the panel. And I suggest that we're going to hand over, firstly, to Charlie to take this forward, the theme of travelling with photography gear. Go, Charlie.
Thank you very much, Ted. Well, I think he raises an interesting point, you know, ensuring your travel gear and, you know, really working out the logistics of how you're going to get from A to B, you know, with your camera equipment. In my case, I do a fair amount of travelling to Southeast Asia, and I always insure my gear with my under my home insurance. I have it covered for £10,000, so if anything happens, accidental or theft, I'm covered there. But I always have a lot of anxiety when I travel with my camera gear, because I'm always worried about being caught out with them getting my bags and basically weighing them. And I did a bit of research online about carriers and their dimensions for the baggage, and it varies a lot. I know in the USA, they're very lenient. They don't weigh your carry-on at all. It's all about dimensions. But they're very easygoing, really. You can get away with even up to 25 kilograms for your carry-on. Whereas in Europe, it's a different story, obviously. You have carriers like Ryanair. They're more draconian with their laws about dimensions and weight. And then you have EasyJet, which surprised me. So I actually went on a trip to Greece last year with EasyJet, and I didn't take a suitcase. I just took a carry-on and a Peak Design 10-litre sling, which I put all my camera gear in. I think I traveled with three lenses at the time and a full-frame camera, my Sony A7C Mark II. And how they did it was they said, okay, you have a set dimension for your carry-on, which was essentially a roller case with a retractable handle, quite a large size. And I put some camera gear in there with my clothing to protect it. And then I put my Peak Design 10-litre sling over the top of it. And that was quite small, but that alone weighed about 10 kilograms. And then my carry-on, the roller, that also weighed about 10 kilograms. And they said that as long as it's 15 kilograms per item, you're okay. As long as it fits into our dimension brackets that we give you, then that's fine. So, you know, that was really good. But if you travel in Asia, it's a different story. They're very strict when it comes to carry-on, especially for short-haul flights. So you've got Thai Airways, you have Nok Air, you have Viet Air, Vietnam Airlines, and they are quite strict, I have found in my experience. But when you go further afield to somewhere like Japan or Taiwan, where they use Cathay Pacific or EVA Air, they're more relaxed, it seems to be. I've seen many people with all types of carry-ons. Some of them even have two roller cases, you know, small ones. So that would be, you know, photographer friendly, so to speak. And it's always awkward when you get to the counter and they want to weigh your luggage. There's several ways you can play it. You can kind of say one of the old tricks is to say that, you know, there's a battery in my lens. You can't put it as checked luggage. That one's quite good. You can also, because I did some research into this, say that, oh, my insurance provider, they won't actually cover me for damage if you put my camera gear in this checked luggage. They'll only cover damage if it's put in as carry-on. I haven't tried that one yet, but I think that's the best one I've heard so far to kind of mitigate against any damage that I could get with my camera lenses traveling. I think really, it's all about trade-offs, isn't it? You can take too much gear and end up not using it. But if I'm honest, I have always used all the camera equipment I take with me. Obviously, there's some lenses I use a bit more than others, like the 135mm lens for the Sony system was one of my favorite lenses, but I ended up selling it just because it was quite cumbersome to use and it wasn't a zoom lens. So it, you know, it really wasn't getting that mileage versus some of my other prime lenses. And now I'm moving more towards zoom lenses. I find them a lot more feasible for travel. So I'm actually going to Hong Kong and Vietnam next month. And I have got an entire suite of lenses. I'm traveling with the 9mm. The Samyang, actually, I should preface that with the TT Artisan, 7 Artisan 9mm, which is a manual lens. The 14-24 Samyang for the auto lens. And then the Sony G Master 24-70 zoom lens. But at the moment, I'm trying to decide whether I need to purchase another lens for this trip because it's a big trip. So I actually want to buy the Sony 70-200.
Of course you do.
And I don't know whether to go
need
for
it.
The...
You don't need it.
I don't need it. Well, you say that, but I mean, you know, if you're doing night photography, Chris, You do want an F2.8 70-200. You don't want the Fisher Price F4 70-200, which I know you do own. I mean, that's going to be useless, isn't it, for night? I think it's
fine.
Really?
Yeah.
I think
much is your carry-on going to weigh? It's going to weigh what, like, with your laptop, your iPad?
I actually have an idea here, and I've already kind of like tested it, so to speak. I got my my carry-on, my with the retractable handle and the wheels, and I fitted my 31-liter Wondered backpack inside, so it's like a bag within a bag inside the carry-on.
That's so worse, I think. Because they're more likely to weigh the hard luggage carry-on. Because my trick was always, has always been, to make your backpack look like a backpack. I put the tripod in the check luggage, so my camera bag looks like a normal backpack.
Yeah,
and they never weigh backpacks.
Yeah, but you're missing something here. That doesn't work for me because we have the same backpack, the same dimensions, but my one's like puffy. It looks bigger than it is. And I've never been weighed with it, but I know they're going to look at it and one day they're going to say, hey, come over here, come out of the queue, we're going to weigh it, you know.
There is that moment of dread. Are they going to weigh it? Because I've never got, I think it's always 7 kilograms on long haul, isn't it?
Yes.
That you get. And mine's
always 10 kilos. That's how much my bag weighs. Like
mine was 12 last time.
12?
Yeah, because I had my MacBook.
You do travel with
an iPad. And a drone, and a battery pack, and all the lenses. So it can get out of hand.
So you know it's overweight, and you just hope they're not going to call you out and weigh it.
Yeah, and then they rarely do, because in long haul they would normally do the weighing at the check-in counter, where they just weigh the big bags, the checks bags, and then they never really look at the carry-on again. And I've seen some outrageous flouting of the carry-on.
Right.
System. I mean, people with two roller luggages, you know, everyone seems to be taking a piss with this carry-on. Yeah. So I figure with just all I take is a backpack and nothing else with my camera gear. And
maybe they're all pro photographers. That's why they all have like two.
Well,
I think it's about having a contingency. So you either go, where I've gone is I've gone for a low pro, rucksack trolley that when you walk up to the counter, you put it on your back like a rucksack and you just turn around to show that you've got a rucksack on. That covers the anxiety a little bit, but also having some other bags or things, lots of pockets that if the worst comes to the worst, that they want you to take stuff out, you can start putting lenses in big pockets and just having that.
Do you think there's a market for like Peak Design and Wondered and GoPro, not GoPro, LowPro, whatever they're called, to make like secondary backpacks as like an emergency backup option if your backpack fails and they say, okay, you've got to put it in with checked luggage. You can like kind of whip out your emergency Peak Design backpack and put all your camera lenses in it. That might be a good idea.
Well, you say that. I was listening to Jared Polin, who you know, you love him or hate him.
Oh, the guy with the afro,
great. So he does a podcast, and as you mentioned earlier, the American Airlines seem more fussed about space rather than weight.
Yes.
And he came a cropper with this, and his bag was too large. So he took, and they made him check it, but he refused for obvious reasons, especially the sort of gear he carries. So he just got a carrier bag and emptied the entire contents out into a carrier bag. And just
a literal carrier bag,
and then threw away his camera bag. Because it's a cost benefit, isn't it? If you lose all your camera gear unchecked, then, you know, that's, for someone like him, it's probably $20,000 worth of, of gear. I'm sure we all are, when we're walking up there, we're thinking, what do we do if they say you've got to check it? You know, what excuses are we going to come up with? Are we going to say there's batteries?
I kind of perform like as I'm getting closer and closer to the check-in counter, I kind of like stand sideways and then I get my backpack and I try and make it look lighter than it is. So if it's on my back with two straps, I will take it off and just try and lightly balance
it. I do that. I do the one strap thing.
Yeah, the one strap. Yeah. Try and make it look effortless. But if someone just grabbed it off me, they'd fall over because it's like 12 kilos.
What were you saying earlier about batteries? You kind of flick past that quickly, but something you can say about batteries?
Yes. So you're not allowed to put lithium batteries in the hold of the aeroplane. So if you say, well, my camera lenses contain lithium batteries, they might say something to the effect of, well, you have to remove them. You could just say no, they're built in. So I have my one lens, the 14 to 24 Samyang. It actually has a USB socket in the lens itself. You can quite clearly see it. But that's not for a battery or for charging. That's just for updating the firmware because it's obviously a third-party lens. It's not a Sony lens. Mm-hmm. But you could, to a normie, you could just show it to them and just say, oh, yeah, it's got a lithium battery in it, and they're going to see the charging port, and they're going to think that is a charging port, even though it's just for backing up the firmware. So you could use that as an excuse. I've never tried it, but I know that would work. But I think the insurance thing, as I said, if you just tell them the truth, your insurance provider won't cover it if it's been put in as checked luggage, which they won't, then that should be sufficient to kind of get you out. Or maybe you can have like a 3D printed like sticker or something of like a USB port you can just put on your lens and just pretend, just pretend that it does have a battery in it, and no one will be none the wiser.
What do you do, Ian, as a business, I presume? Do you have like some kind of different insurance, or do you do it all through your personal insurance?
So I've got public liability insurance that I have, and I have an add-on to that, which is camera kit insurance. But it's interesting what you were saying, Charlie, that I haven't had to do it, but it's in my book of excuses, which is very extensive around the insurance, and saying that their insurance wouldn't cover this equipment if it went into the hold. Again, I probably have, when I travel, probably 8 batteries maybe with me. So again, it's quite heavy, but touch wood, I haven't had to do that. The closest I came was I was traveling to Melbourne earlier this year, and I was in the queue for the hop from Sydney to Melbourne, and there was a couple of guys in front of me with their trolley cases, and they started weighing them and asking them to check them, and then I just started getting this cold sweat. And then I put this big ruck, put it on my back, and made out that it was really very, very light, and managed to blag my way through. But it's always, I'm sure, Charlie, Chris, yourself, that it's always that worry. It's never a nice experience of having to think of all the excuses you're going to come up with to get your carry-on on. So
the question is, if it came down to it and they were forcing you to put it in the checked luggage, this is something I've asked myself, what would you do? Would you just not get on the flight? Because what's the percentage chance that all your gear is going to get smashed up? Well, it's got to be more than 50%, isn't it, the way they throw these bags around?
Yeah.
So would you say, I'm just not getting on the flight then? Or I do wonder what would happen if it came to it. Would you risk it?
I've seen some guys have... So, I've got the couple of options. The low-pro Trekker, which is really cool because it is a rucksack, but it's a hard case, and you can fit two bodies. I've got a 14 to 28, 24 70, 70 to 200, 160 to 600, and I can fit all of that in there, plus all the batteries, teleconverter, everything else I put in like a monopod or tripod. It goes in my checked luggage. That works really well because it is designed to fit into the size. Obviously it's super heavy. The other alternative I've used, I've got a Shimoda Action, which has got a roll top on it, so you can put your coat and bits and pieces in it. But the cool thing is it's got the cube in it, like the Peak Design cube, that if they say it's too big, you can actually take the camera cube out and just carry that on. So I initially got that for when I was doing landscape and stuff, but it was the excuse that, okay, if you won't let me have my rucksack, I can just take this cube on. It may be very heavy, but it's very small and it has all my bodies and lenses in it.
Cool. Okay. So going back to the, I think largely Rohan's initial point is about insurance. And you mentioned there a couple of brief glimpses of what people do for insurance. And the companies that people use to take out specialist insurance is different to, I think, what Charlie said at the outset, which was about just using your house contents insurance. Does anyone, apart from doing it professionally, like you're saying, Ian, anyone got separate insurance? Are we recommending to Rohan that he does take out specialist insurance, or make sure that he... Yep.
Yeah, with the insurance, you can't just go and use your home insurance and not notify the home insurance provider that, until you have something wrong with your camera gear, you have to tell them beforehand. So in my case, I'm with Aviva. I actually itemized everything for them. I don't think I gave them receipts, but I itemized everything for them and told them the exact cost of when I bought it. What it was, its specification, its model number, its serial number, and also the date I purchased it on. So they have all the info there. You have to be quite precise. You can get specialist camera insurance, but I think that's quite expensive. So I don't know if that's going to be worthwhile, especially if I'm a hobbyist, even though I do have a lot of camera gear. I wouldn't class myself as a pro, so I don't think... Although the professional insurance would be cheaper, to cover my camera gear if it was stolen, I don't think it would be worthwhile necessarily. I think a home insurance provider would be better for most people, but you have to tell them all your gear and equipment and what it is and give them the receipts and invoices. Yeah.
Right. And now you're making me paranoid because I haven't done any of that. I've got contents insurance. Yeah, I've got contents insurance.
Are you serious?
Yeah, I have contents insurance.
Are you serious? You need to itemize it. Just think.
There's an option. I haven't just got normal insurance. I have got there's an option for high value electronics up to £10,000, including cameras. And that's what I ticked.
Yeah, but what do you want to cover it for? Have you got it covered for fire? Have you got it covered for theft? Have you got it covered for damage? If someone drives over your gear in a van or a car, is it covered for that?
Oh, I wouldn't know. I mean, that's...
Well, that happened to Tim. So, Ted, we actually have a friend who is a professional photographer, and his half his camera gear was run over by a van, and he managed miraculously to get it covered by his insurance provider. I don't know how, but I know they were quite nitpicky about it, and he managed to actually get the gear all covered, and I think they repaired it in the end for him.
Well, there you go.
I do know yeah.
It probably depends on the company. Back in the day when I had expensive camera gear, I did use my home contents insurance, but there was a bit like you were saying, there was a thing in it that said all risks. That was the phrase that they used, was all risks. And then they inside that all risks bit, you had to kind of say what you had and what it was worth. So it may be a crossover between the two models here.
Yeah, I mean, the one I've got, it just says high-value electronics up to £10,000 per item.
Yeah.
But that's as far as I've really got into
it. Yeah, but that's an umbrella term, Chris. So, yes, you're correct. It will cover you, but only under specific instances. So, as you know, with insurance companies, they will try and get out of it. If it was stolen from you, they probably won't cover you. If it was, like, smashed accidentally by someone else, they might cover you. But if it was smashed by yourself, they probably won't cover you. I think they're just using an umbrella term. With me, they were very specific, and they asked me, what did I want cover for? And I said I wanted cover for everything. And obviously, I had to pay extra for that.
Oh, you're very risk averse, though, Charles. That's the difference, isn't it? I'm a little bit more freewheeling, I suppose.
I only ever had to claim for one camera, which I dropped off a harbour wall. But that wasn't abroad, and I wasn't travelling, so it's probably not that relevant. But the insurance company, because I had that in part of my all-risk thingy, I was taking photographs off of this harbour wall in the northeast of Scotland, and it just went out of my hands, and it was gone. And they replaced it without any question at all. They almost didn't really want to know anything about it because I paid extra for this all-risk section. But I don't know. I mean, that was 40 years ago. So that may be different now. I'm just trying to get to the point where we're recommending what to do to Rohan, really.
I think travel insurance, again, I think that's very limited. As I say, from my side, I think my add-on for equipment, which I think covers up to either 10 or 15, was an extra £80 a year or something like that for the insurance policy. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think standard travel insurance, and probably Charlie, probably correct me if I'm wrong, you're very limited on individual items, and I guess. A camera body is well over 1,000, let alone many lenses. So
yeah, travel insurance I wouldn't rely on at all. I had to try and do travel insurance once in my life, and they were useless for fairly what I would consider routine claim, and they wouldn't honour it. So trying to claim on sort of £3,000-4,000 worth of camera gear, I think, would be a non-starter.
It depends how much you've got, I suppose. The other thing to mention is that some bank accounts or building society accounts bundle in. To give you an example, my dad's got this insurance via his Nationwide account, and it's got all sorts of things in it, and you can't opt out of it. It's like, that's it. It's part of the bundle. That's what comes with the account. You've got this insurance. And he's claimed on that a couple of times for not camera gear, but quite expensive things, and also, you know, flood damage in the house and that sort of thing. And it might be just worth checking what is bundled in with your bank account. May not be specialists enough for this, but worth a look.
Also, to invest in a proper strap for your camera as well, so you mitigate the risk of dropping it if you're going on holiday, like he's going to Sri Lanka or something like that. Again, you may have a couple of lenses and one body. Just make sure it's on you and very difficult to drop. So
yeah, and avoid hanging off harbour walls.
Exactly.
And if you want to cover yourself against theft, you can also buy a hand grip. I don't know for which camera it was for. I think it was for Nikon. And you can actually put an air tag inside the handle of the hand grip.
Oh, right, yeah.
So, and it's concealed as well. So, you know, if it's stolen from you or stolen from the back of your car, you'll still be able to keep track of it.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
But what happens when you track them down into some sort of gang headquarters?
tell the police.
Yeah, they'll help for sure.
It's a very comprehensive little table you've drawn up there, though, Charlie. So thanks for that. I'll stick that in the album if it's not already there. And
you can actually see on the table, I think it's worth noting, Delta United, so for the USA. Now, I haven't been to the USA for a long time, so I can't really comment in regards to camera equipment. But I just wanted to mention Peak Design. Now, they released a few months ago, and it was on their, I think it was a Kickstarter campaign or something where you put some money in up front and you got like a discount. They released the Peak Design Roller Carry-On, which weighs nearly 4 to 5 kilograms empty. So I had to do some research into this, as in why would anyone get a carry-on that's almost 5 kilos empty? And it turns out that in the US, weight isn't enforced as it is in Europe or Asia. So you've already burnt half your allowance before you've even packed out all your camera gear and lenses. So that just goes to show you the how it differs, you know, between countries and continents with weight and allowances,
mm.
The carry-on.
Certainly does. So thanks for that. Hope that's been a bit of help to you, Rohan. Anything else anyone wants to say on that before we head towards the news and the rumours?
I think the EasyJet one's interesting. I've never known that before. Again, you think of that with the Ryanairs and people like that. If you are flying Europe and you have got 15 kg and all of that could be camera gear rather than anything else. So
I must say, though, I think I actually paid extra for that. So I was traveling without a suitcase, without check-in. So I paid, it was quite cheap. I think it was £20 or something. And I was able to take on a roller carry-on for 15 kilos and then something that was either like what they classed as a messenger bag or a handbag. So it was smaller in dimension, but as long as it met the required footprint and it was 15 kilos or so, I was okay. So I could take 30 kilos, essentially, as carry-on.
Cool.
Excellent.
So there you go. Check your traveling stuff. All right, okay, let's do a bit of a catch-up before we get to the news and so on of what people have been doing in the last fortnight since we last recorded. Let's start with Ian. Where have you been? What have you been doing?
So I went to Abu Dhabi for the final F1 race, which was very cool. Great experience being there for the title decider. Interesting types of photographs. The other good thing was that there was a test day afterwards, so there was a full day of 8 hours of running, which was really good. I decided to take my Instax Mini 70, which is an instant camera, to document the trip as well, which was kind of fun, because you only had 20 shots, and for being away for sort of 8 days, it's tried to plan those so you could get the final one at the end of the trophy and stuff. So that was kind of fun. And it was nice to get something tangible out straight away and something that I'll probably put into a scrapbook. I also went to the Grand Mosque, which was on my day off on the Monday, which was a great opportunity. A massive mosque in Abu Dhabi, quite well known. It's so big, it's got a shopping centre underneath it. And I managed to get there just after sunset. But it got some interesting photos, and again, the whole scale of it was a great opportunity to take some shots. I haven't really spent too much time on the images that I got off my Z8. Z6. I took my Z6 and the 24-70. I wish I'd have brought an extra lens, the 14-28, to get a bit wider. But I think that's where the phone comes into play, and I was quite happy with some of the phone photographs I got there as well. So, cool. And then the other thing was I ordered a reflect lens, black hole. So these are a set of filters that you put onto your camera, which are quite interesting. I got this one to take to the race, but with FedEx and their tardiness of delivery from Poland, it took over 2 weeks to arrive, and it arrived just as I was on the train into London to get my flight. So I didn't manage to take that with me, which I was a bit annoyed about, but I did manage to take it to London on Tuesday this week. And again, it gives a completely different dimension. So I got a few shots on Westminster Bridge. Nothing really special, but it does make something out of nothing. And headed back St. Paul's Way and got a few interesting shots of St. Paul's with the black hole effect. I think I may get a couple more of these, especially if I'm going to do some night shooting next year. As say, it does add something to a bit of a boring shot, to be honest.
What's it doing? What is it?
So it is a big glass filter that screws onto the end of your lens.
Right.
And it causes a black hole effect. So if you see the one on Westminster Bridge, it brings out all of the colours, and it gives quite an interesting effect. Again, that one there's pretty much straight out of the camera. And the one of St. Paul's, as I say, I've got quite a number. As I say, it brings out the colour, and it's sort of a black hole. So it will give you a sort of a circular effect on the image. But again, it's something
filter
to
play on both photos. Is that the same filter? Or is it?
Yeah. Yeah, it's just okay. picked up the colour from the Christmas tree in St. Paul's compared to the sort of the neon lights on Westminster Bridge.
Oh, I see. And the red coat. That's influencing the right. Okay. Yeah.
So it's never going to win any of competitions or anything like that. But it's something quite fun to have a play around with. As say. Going to London, it was very overcast, drizzly day. Apart from beers and lunch, photography-wise, the sky wasn't particularly great. But as it got dark, putting this on, it gave it something different to come away with, as opposed to your normal shots. So.
Very interesting. Yeah, definitely.
I really like the mosque. That looks like such a fantastic location.
Yeah.
And it's free to get in. I mean, it's you have to book it, but it's very epic. I heard a lot of this a YouTuber, Roman Fox. I really like his stuff, but he was complaining that there's certain photo spots that you have to stand on this spot. That's where you take the photograph, and that there are guards again around. Not allowing you to move from certain spots, but it wasn't as militant as he made out. But it is quite interesting that this is the spot where you take photographs. You move to the next spot where you take photographs, and me ignoring that. So
yeah, it'd be nice. I mean, it looks right up my street. You got the symmetry and the reflections and everything. So it would be a shame if you weren't allowed to freely kind of get different compositions, because I think I could spend a day there.
Yeah, I think I wish I had spent longer, and I say I was trying to get there for sunset, but left a little bit late, and I just got the last bit of it. And again, I think the shots with people in them are more interesting. Obviously, it's very busy, so trying to have the odd person in there, I think, is quite good as well. So I had to play around with one, which I put in the album, leaving one person in there, which had the same sort of colours as the mosque. I thought that was kind of interesting.
Did you have to remove a few people as well?
There was a few on that, but not an awful lot. To be honest, I think I was a lot luckier with my phone. Because I could pretty much dunk that in the water and get the reflections with my camera. I'm still learning my way around the Z6, so I'm still struggling a little bit to get the best out of it. But yeah, I mean, if you have an opportunity, either going to Dubai or Abu Dhabi, it's definitely a spot for photography. Yeah, definitely.
Somebody in the group was raving about the orange background on one of the cars there, which is in the shared album, and that's very impressive. Anything you want to say about that?
I'll look at the shared album 2 sec. So yeah, I'm on the wrong one. Bear with me.
Yeah, the car.
Yeah, the orange background. One thing about the race is that it's a day-night race, so it sort of goes into the evening. And on the test day, which is on the Tuesday, they get rid of all of the TV gantries and bits and pieces. So where you've got a sort of silhouette of the car and the photo and the orange background, on race weekend, you would have scaffolding and it would be very messy. Mm-hmm. But for the test day, they remove all of that because they haven't got all the TV equipment. And it is the pretty much the last shot of the day that the test runs until 6. And this was about 5:45 when you're just getting the sunset. So I was quite happy I got that shot.
So
I really like your photo here. I think it's photo number 7 where you've got a car and there's like a shadow as it's going into the tunnel. Could you talk me through that one? Was there any thought process there, or did you kind of time that one?
Yeah, so that is so if you got the orange shot with the car right at the top, what happens is that they go down and then round and come out onto the racetrack. So the pit lane exit is through this tunnel. And this was during the day, and you had the lights going round there, but you also had this great shadow, which was going across, and it thought, if I can get the car just bumping up, and so you've got that sort of triangular angle of the car at the front as well as the shadow. And again, I took quite a few shots to get one that was near enough like that.
Yeah, it's a great shot. I really like it.
And as I say, it wasn't all I did was darken up the tunnel a little bit on the right-hand side. If you look at the image next to that, that's the car gone round that corner and then coming out. So there is a little bit round there that you can get round. But as I say, that's the shot. I had a list of shots I'd like to get when I went there, and that was the one I was looking to get. So the car isn't as sharp as I would have liked it to be, but I think I got what I could do. So
what metering mode were you using when you took that one? Do you know?
I was...
Any idea?
No, none at all. Okay. I think, again, I was... That was a... I think it was... again, fast shutter speed. Most of the stuff I shoot is probably around 1/60th to get it.
This is really fast. It says it's 1/1250th of a second, so that is a fast.
Yeah, and the camera is on the ground, and I was again tilting up with the screen, so you're pretty much at ground level, and just as the car's coming round, just firing off to hopefully get that one where, again, you've got the lining up with the shadow. But I think some of the ones where you're cutting through the car as well with the shadow is quite interesting, because, again, you get the bright colours of the livery on the car, but also you've got it going into the darkness. But, yeah, it's for me, it was one of the shots I wanted to get. I was quite lucky to have... As I say, Tuesday for test day, the challenge around Formula One is that sessions are very, very short, and you don't get 8 hours of track time that we did on test day. For that, you can take your time a little bit rather than trying to rush all the shots. So it was quite nice to have that opportunity.
And your shots on the Instax camera, you've taken 20... And you've used your film up and you've looked at them and you thought, that's nice. It's a nice little journal of the day or whatever. And what are you going to do with them now?
So the aim was to, I'm going to be putting last year I did a calendar, a sort of charity calendar with some of the shots. This year I wanted to do a photo book. So I was going to do a photo book of the images of the motorsport stuff I've shot this year. But what I was going to do was where I'd get to the Abu Dhabi bit, was going to have a bit in the photo book and actually stick them in. So it would be an extra, I would have a blank few pages which would document that. And just there as a sort of a memory of 2025 and the memory of that race weekend.
You'd make a feature of the fact that it looks like Polaroids, and even perhaps hand write some notes under each one of them.
So I'd like to have maybe there was a few shots that I wanted to get. One of the ones I wanted to convey was one of the shots there, which was when the drivers arrive at the track. There is an absolute melee of photographers just lining up to take photos of them.
Yeah.
And I was on the top of the gate. I wanted to get that shot of the driver coming in and all the photographers. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to get it on the Instax as well. So I went up there, took the instant one, and then took a shot on my camera. Just as that memory of behind the sort of scenes of sort of not... I think the interesting ones are maybe not of the cars, but of the people and the background to it. So, mm-hmm. yeah. Cool. But yeah, I thought it was a fun thing to do.
Yeah.
Again, it makes you wary of when where you're going to take a shot or not, and if you're going to waste it. And good fun.
Yeah, good stuff. Okay, thanks a lot, Ian. Right, let's move on to Chris. Some of your photographs from the last fortnight.
Nothing particularly revolutionary for me, I'm afraid. Just my normal trip down to the Brighton Beach on Saturday morning. It was really nice conditions, really nice light. The tide height was perfect for the kind of low exposure and medium exposure shots I was trying to get. So I kind of just planted myself in front of the West Pier for the duration of the sunrise and just played about with different shutter speeds. I got absolutely drenched because the tide caught me out and it went out to my knees. So my waterproof shoes weren't much help because all the water was inside them. So I just sort of accepted my fate, accepted my soggy feet and just sort of stood there for about a half hour, just playing with different shutter speeds, going sort of between a tenth of a second up to sort of 3 or 4 seconds and just seeing what worked best with getting the water coming in or going back out. And it was good fun to get out there, but as I say, it's not anything I've not taken before, so run of the mill. I got a nice one of the starlings. Not often you see them like this in the morning. You see them in the evening quite a lot, but it's quite rare to see them in the mornings like this. So many of them, they're normally a bit more sort of spread out across them between the piers and the marina. So that was a nice photo. But as I say, nothing too exciting. Probably my favourite one was the sort of the wider angle from further up the beach. This was about a half hour after sunrise. And I just like the pink cloud that kind of framed the pier. And then you've got another photographer who's doing some photos and you can see like his ghost throughout. I can't remember how long it was, maybe a minute and a half the exposure. So you've just got him sort of moving. He's on the right of the scene, then he's in the middle. And I kind of like that. But yeah, that was it really. Just the usual stuff for me, I'm afraid.
I quite like the one with the photographer and his tripod. I think.
Oh yeah, the silhouette. Yeah,
yeah. That's. I think that's a really nice shot, and documenting some guy with his rucksack on and enthusiastic photographer. Not you, is it?
It's not me. I got the trouble is with these late sunrises is that you get a lot more people coming out for him. There was 4 tripods out there that morning.
Oh, wow.
It was normally just me. So,
yes.
Yeah.
I quite like that one. I'm not quite sure.
Yeah, I like the silhouette is really cool. Yeah.
Yeah, very nice.
Thanks.
Some nice, but yeah, you're right. I didn't even notice the ghosts of the photographer in that wide one. That's really interesting. And the one that got the most interesting talk on the group was the... what's the word? Murmurating?
Murmuration, yes.
Right.
They murmurate, and this is a murmuration. I guess if you don't live in Brighton, it's kind of a nice, but it's something you see every day here, so it wasn't that interesting for us. But, it's kind of nice, I suppose.
Yeah.
I need to go away and see some new things.
Japan calls you.
I'll go to Thailand in June, but it's a long way off.
Yeah. Right, okay, lead us into rumours. Does anyone else want to talk about any... Charlie, did you want to talk about any photographs you've been taking recently or not?
Unfortunately, Ted, the only photos I have here are of my rucksack with my camera.
Okay, that's fine.
It's sad, isn't it? I haven't taken any photos, really, not since my... incidents in London kind of put me off, but you can just see the photos here. You've got my Wonder 31 liter just to show you what you can get in it. It's a very large backpack. You've got the tripod there, you've got all my lenses. You can probably get another 2 lenses in there. And you can also buy these compartments. So the camera gear there is in a detachable part, compartment. And you can also get a second compartment for the top bit, which you can see there in the photo. I've got the Ricoh GR there.
Hurrah.
My case. Yeah, and your favorite camera. And my case filters, which I'm proud to say I have only used once. And they were not
cheap. How much were they?
$550 Five?
Oh, dear.
Yeah, and I need to buy a black
case. Worth every penny.
So it's a well-packed bag, certainly. It's very well organized.
Yes.
Because it never takes them out, Ted. That's why.
Were you upgrading your body? I saw you were posted you were selling one of your cameras. You're upgrading?
Yeah. I sold my beloved Sony A7 Mark II. And I upgraded to the Sony A7 R5, which has 61 megapixels versus the A7 C2, which had 31 megapixels. So I have more pixels to crop, basically. Also, I have a proper screen, like a tilt screen, on the A7 II, it doesn't have that. The tilt screen kind of pops out, and I always feel like I'm going to snap it off when I'm like doing shooting in the street. So it wasn't very good. And I have an EV with, I think it's 3 times more pixel density, so it's just a clearer image when you look through it, and more buttons. So obviously more customization. I have a button now for my different metering modes. I didn't have that before. It's all customizable. And now I have a dedicated button for cropping. So if I want to take a shot and really crop in, I don't have to go into the menus and find out. I can just do it instantly. So it's a fantastic camera. But as I said, I haven't really used it yet. The only downside is it's 200 grams heavier. It weighs about 700 grams. The A7 C2 weighed, I think, 500. But it's all trade-offs, isn't it? But it's a good camera. You can see here in the pictures, I've got my slings. You've got the Peak Design 10 litre, which is good. It's more suited for my new camera. I might have to sell the 6 litre sling. It's just, you can get everything in it, but the problem is taking it out. Because my new camera has a bigger EV, it's kind of raised, so the dimensions are slightly larger on the camera. You just can't pop it in and out of the satchel as easy as you can with the 10 litre, so I might have to get rid of that and keep the 10. But that's just to give you an idea of my travel bags. When I go away, I just take one of the slings, depending on where I'm going, and the backpack, and that kind of covers me, really.
Or yeah. You might just take the GR.
I could, Ted, but what am I going to do at night time? I'd have to use a flash.
Tripod.
No, you can't use a Ricoh GR with a tripod. That's a crime. Definitely not.
Okay. All right, let's move on. Chris, let's get some rumours and news rolling, shall we?
Okie doke. Shame Chris Kelly's not here, because you're going to be the man I go to for this one, Ted. Fujifilm is working on a camera with a time travel dial. This doesn't actually send you back in time, unfortunately, but it can send your photos back in time to a world of grainy, unsaturated images. but I guess if you know the film stocks, you can sort of choose different film stocks. Is that the idea?
I think you can. But digital cameras are kind of doing this stuff anyway, to be honest, aren't they?
Yeah.
I think the news here is that they're making a retro looking feeling camera with an actual dial on it, and the novelty value of actually being able to put the date in. Very silly, but bit of fun.
Well, we can mock it, but these Fuji sort of gimmicks do seem to sell, so
yeah, they do,
especially in Japan. They love all that kind of stuff, don't they?
Chris, are we talking about that Fuji camera that's a half sensor with the it doesn't have a horizontal mode? Or
no, that's the X half, which X-half, apparently is Japan's best-selling camera.
Yeah,
which is amazing, unfathomable to me. But no, this is something else. So
Okay.
Yeah, we'll see. What we got here? Canon, a Canon 200 1.8. Well, that's going to be big. Yeah, so new Canon have got a patent for a 200 1.8, which will be the first mirrorless 200 fast lens. I think Sigma released one recently, didn't they? Sigma F2, there it is. So the Sigma F2 was £3,000. So Canon isn't known for being cheap. So I would be quite worried about how much this lens would cost. But, I mean, that would be a lot of fun, though. And is you that, like a long lens, don't you,
is,
Ted?
Is so that...
200 1.8.
Is that a... It says it's reintroduced it. And that picture we've got in the recording notes there looks like it's pretty battered, so...
Yeah, so that's an old DSLR lens, isn't it?
Oh, I see.
So they're obviously bringing it back for mirrorless systems, so hopefully it wouldn't be quite as enormous.
Oh, right. Oh, okay.
Is this a prime lens?
It's a prime, yeah. It's a prime.
It looks massive. I've got to be honest.
There's also a patent for a 300 F2. I can't imagine how big that would be.
Yeah.
But it's just, it would be. It would be. But wow. For a certain use case, I suppose, if you want to like do a portrait shot of someone's, and the only thing that's in focus is like an eyelash or something, then
Ian, you said you had a lens that was it 150 to 600?
It is 180 to 600, yeah. 5.6 to 6.4, I think.
And how much does that weigh? Is that a big lens?
Yeah. I mean, it's not as big as the 400 2.8. It's definitely, I've had a rucksack before, I have a separate bag with that to carry that, and that's fine. I mean, it fits in my roller about. But I just invested in a range extender of 1.7. And I found I hardly use the 600, to be honest. The 2.8 now goes to F4, and I get 300mm on that, I think. It's,
And you can use a teleconverter. Are they called teleconverters?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it was about £300, and quite useful to, again, just to pop on the lens to get an extra bit of reach on it. It's pretty cool.
Hmm. Good idea.
Well, it's a bit of a beast, right. That one, isn't it? Okay, go on, Chris.
All right, we'll just move on to the news.
Yep.
I want to quickly mention the Sony A7 5 again. I know we mentioned it last week as a new release, but there was a bit of consternation about the sensor because with some testing, the dynamic range and lack of noise was so good that there was accusations that Sony was baking in noise reduction to RAW files, which is something that I think Canon do, which they get a lot of criticism for. But it actually turns out that it's not being, there is no noise reduction in the RAW files. They're actually using dual gain output. So what they're doing is compiling an image at ISO 100 and an image at ISO 800, and they're merging them into one RAW file, so obviously you're going to get a lot more dynamic range. So this actually has dynamic range equal to the Sony A7R5, but you don't lose all the speed that you sacrifice on that camera. So this is kind of revolutionary, and it's, I think Panasonic did this with a 24 megapixel sensor. They were the first ones to do it, but they use Sony sensors. But this is the first time that this has been done on a high resolution sensor at 33 megapixels. And it's basically phone style computational photography, but in a fourth frame camera. So it's kind of a big deal, and there is no downside to it, really. And this is something that I've been banging on about for a while, is how all the computational stuff is stuck in the Micro Four Thirds system at the sort of the highest end, and obviously in phones. But now we're getting it in full frame, so I hope it continues. It does mean though that Charlie's brand new camera is obsolete, and he should have waited a week and bought this instead.
Thanks a lot.
How much is the A7 5?
£3,000.
£3,000.
Yeah, well, 2,900.
That's too much.
Well, that's the price of a mid-range camera these days.
Yeah. Yeah. It's very similar to a Z8 Nikon. So.
Yeah. That's fully stacked, is it not, the Z8?
Yeah.
Yeah. But it's all trade-offs. So I just wanted to quickly mention that. I know Ed put a little comment about that in the group, Ed House. So we'll see if anything else comes in later bodies.
What's interesting is that these firms, well, Sony in this case, are still working on stuff, and they're not just leaving it to phone manufacturers and, in his case, four-thirds stuff, that they're still plugging away and thinking up new ideas and trying to work it through and make things better. So it is interesting, you're right.
Well, the entire, excluding Canon, the entire mirrorless camera market uses Sony sensors. Canon and Sony are the only people that make sensors. So right. If Sony aren't innovating, then the whole industry kind of is going to suffer for it.
Yeah.
So, it's kind of interesting, really, how much monopoly they have, sort of, in terms of the parts.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, it is. Sad news about Martin Parr as well. A couple of weeks back, he died. He was only 73. But I did like his stuff. I'm not really a big street kind of candid photographer fan, but I found his stuff interesting because it was sort of capturing, you know, the arse end of nowhere, seaside places. Was it New Brighton? Blackpool, places like that. That he
Bristol.
Was capturing. Bristol.
apparently he lived in Bristol. Yes.
Right.
I think it was Chris Kelly who was talking about him before, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Chris is a big fan. So I don't know if anyone else is familiar with his work.
Do you know when he was shooting, what kind of decade was most of his core work? When was that taken?
It was early 90s, I think.
Really? Okay.
I could be wrong.
I loved his work. I thought it was really great.
It is. It was interesting, and it without being too
cliche. Was it staged, or was it actually...
No, he focused on real people, but he would get them to sort of... But he never said he was a candid street photographer, to be fair. He said it was more of a documentarian.
I love some of these photos. If you click through from the article that we've linked to into the Guardian, and there's a whole bunch of his great street work in there, and it's just wonderful. I love that kind of stuff. It's just super. Rico GR will give me that.
Oh, that's the next story. Yeah, so Rico GR4
HDF.
Don't buy the 4, Ted.
Buy the 3.
Yeah. Well, Charlie, is this worth it, GR4?
I looked into this. I don't think so. They've changed, so you have the dial, but they've added like a plus and minus button next to it, so you can change the exposure compensation if you're using it in aperture priority mode. But I don't know how good that is unless I was to actually get the GR4 and test it myself. The ergonomics are terrible on the camera, so I just use it in AP mode. But, I mean, if that's your thing, go for the GR4. But I don't think it's worth the extra money, honestly.
No. I agree. Would you go for the, for argument's sake, Ted, if you were buying one and you had a spare grand, would you get this Black Mist HDF version, or would you get the one with the ND filter in it?
I actually... I don't feel qualified to answer the question, to be honest. I think that Charlie is the man to answer it. At the moment, it's so far out of my range to get either of them that I've not kind of looked more deeply into it. If I was to get a spare grand, or 1,200 quid in this case, I would then certainly be researching that kind of thing and answer the question. Charlie, rescue me.
I'm going to say that the Black Mist is beneficial for you, but you don't need it. All it does is it takes light and it makes it diffuse. It makes it glow. But I was actually playing about with Photoshop yesterday, and you can actually get 80 to 90% of the way there. I mean, a man on the street wouldn't be able to tell the difference between a case filter which is, say, a 1/4 black mist on your camera lens versus something you've done in post on Photoshop when you make black mist artificially.
Right.
You know, it's really quite good if you, you know, if you do it in Photoshop. But it's always best to do it in camera. You can't really beat that. But I don't think you need it. I don't think you need to pay that much, you know, just for a black mist. If you really wanted to go that route, then you could just buy the actual physical filter and just attach it to a cheaper Ricoh GR.
Watch this space.
Okay. Just a shout out for Nikon, who are still updating their Z9 4 years after it came out with some pretty significant updates. They basically overhauled the autofocus system, and it's, I don't think it was bad to start with, but it's even better now. So I'll just throw over to Ian, who's in the Nikon system. So looking at this, Ian, are you waiting for this to come to yours? Are you keen for these updates?
I think they've made some big moves forward on the autofocus and the tracking. So for fast-moving subjects, again, the ballpark that I'm sort of shooting, that would be great. I mean, I think the good thing about Nikon is that the firmware flows down, so the Z8 and Z9 are very similar cameras, and I'm sure this will come down to the Z8 as well. But it is quite reassuring that they don't do this thing, which I think, I don't want to insult Sony users, but I'm sure with Sony that they keep some of the features for the latest model to try and get people to upgrade rather than updating the firmware on older ones. So I think that's quite a user-friendly piece of trying to keep your customers happy and keep that supported. But definitely the autofocus stuff looks good. The tracking stuff, but there's also some additions to face detection in some of the wider modes of focusing. So yeah, I mean, it looks good. From what I read, maybe springtime that the Z8 may get this. So looking forward to that.
Nikon, from what I've read, are really, really good at updates. Like they give you meaningful updates, and they update all their cameras for a long time, which, as you say, Sony don't do. And when Sony do send an update, they seem to break half the cameras that they update. So I think I'm about four versions behind on my camera with the updates, but nothing ever comes out that I feel is worth updating it for. So I just think, what's the point? Yeah. But they have a real bad situation where they keep bricking cameras within the first couple of weeks of these updates, so you need to always wait a little while with Sony.
How do you unbrick them?
You have to send it back to Sony, but of course, in our case, where we've got it on grey market. You have no recourse. You're just going to end up with a literal brick. So,
right.
Yeah, just beware when you do the updates. I think that's it, to be honest, with the news. It's a bit of a slow time of year, so yeah.
Okay, that's fine. Bit of a shorter show this time, but we're still well over the hour, so it's not that short. We'll be back in a fortnight's time. Thank you for joining me today. TedSalmon.com/camera creations is where you'll find our website and links to all the stuff that we've been talking about on this show. The Google Photos Camera Creations shared album is also linked, and that's where you'll find photographs and images about what we've been talking about today. So when you're listening to the podcast, you can have a look in there. And if you get lost with anything else, podcasts and MeWe groups and all the rest of it, you can find it all at tedsalmon.com. Thanks for listening. Hope you've enjoyed it. And we'll be back again in a fortnight's time with some more interesting stuff on New Year's Eve, quite possibly. Take care.